Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about that kind of a violation. And of course, also a lot about issues of a bigger decay. Let me start. So, well, in general, yeah, I'm going to talk.
You don't have a microphone on you.
Oh, that's true.
Microphone where are you? Even though we understand you very well.
So I just put it on, not that I have to do anything else with it.
I didn't have it on.
Okay, so I kind of want to view lepton number violation in the center of the complementary context of neutron star beta decay, LHC physics, and the baryon asymmetry of the universe. Okay.
Switched on.
And before I get into this, let me briefly remind you, why is it interesting to talk about lepton number violation? Or why is it particularly interesting? And this is connected to the question, why is the non-vanishing neutrino mass connected to physics beyond the standard law? And so when we say the discovery of neutrino mass means we have some hint for physics beyond the standard model, what we mean is if we write down a neutrino mass, we can do it in two ways. Of course, we can write down Dirac mass, or we can write down a Majorana mass. And if we write down a Majorana mass, of course, we have lepton number violation. But if we write down a Dirac mass, then we have two possibilities now. We have now this Riemann neutrino here. And by gauge invariants, Majorana mass for the Riemann neutrino is not forbidden. So in principle, we can write down a Majorana mass for the Riemann neutrino. So we also have the mass term mu r c bar, mu r, mm, like we have in the seesaw 1 mechanism. And then again, we have lepton number violation. Or we don't have this mass term. And this means we have to do something to forbid it. So we have a new symmetry, for example, lepton number. So this is why I think lepton number violation or conservation is a particularly important question, since it's at the very core of connecting neutrino masses with physics beyond the standard law. Now, how do we learn about whether lepton number is conserved or violated? Well, the most prominent probe is neutrino star beta. I want to start with that and then come to the other two topics. So the most prominent probe, which is the beta decay, and among the neutron double beta decays, the most prominent again is what we call the mass mechanism. Which works with standard model, charge current interactions, d quarks go into 2u quarks. Here we have a u minus, an electron, a neutrino, and here we have a mass insertion into an antineutrino. And the whole thing here, the amplitude is proportional to this propagator here, which is PL from the weak interaction, N plus V slash over P squared PL, and the left-handed projectors, they project out the mass here. So the whole thing is proportional to the neutrino mass. And that's what people discuss, that from neutrinos double beta decay, you can learn something about the absolute neutrino mass. But in general, every diagram which transforms 2d quarks into 2u quarks into electrons gives rise to neutrinos double beta decay. So, and this general thing we can decompose now into different contributions. Here again, our mass mechanism. So I rotated the time axis now to make it more interesting. So you can have two vertices separated by the exchange of the light neutrino here, where the vertices are standard model vertices. This is our mass mechanism proportional to the neutrino mass. Or you can have one non-standard vertex here and one standard model vertex separated by a light neutrino. Or you can have two such non-standard vertices separated by a light neutrino. So this is proportional to epsilon squared, and since epsilon is typically assumed to be a small contribution to the standard model processes, this thing here will always be smaller than this thing here, so we probably can neglect it.
Yes. But they also version 2 mu, no?
Not necessarily, since the mu comes from this PL, PL. And this new interaction here can have a PR structure. And then you project out the P slash here, and the whole thing is not proportional to mu anymore.
Okay.
Of course, there's the Schechter-Wallis theorem, that whenever you have neutrinos double beta decay, you also have a non-vanishing neutrino Malvana mass. Since on a for loop level, you can use this diagram and put neutrinos here somehow, and then you get a for loop diagram which creates a Majorana mass for the neutrinos, but this Majorana mass is not directly proportional to the amplitude of these processes.
However, the process violates Lepton number.
That's true.
You've got to violate that Lepton number somehow. And if the interactions in the diagram do not do so, then you are depending on the Majorana mass to do so.
That's okay. So then most, what you're saying actually is that you must have Lepton number inside that block. So the Lepton number violation must be happening inside that block.
Of course.
If not, there's some MU in the...
That's true. Yeah, I agree with that. And so then we have the case, where everything is point-like, and you might ask what the scale for putting these effective vertices blocks here. That's a typical scale for nuclear physics. An interaction looks point-like when the mass in this blob is larger than 100 MeV, right? So 100 MeV is the typical energy of the neutrino here, which is given by the separation of two nucleons in the nucleus.
What if you have some other particle which is also light, but it's not the neutrino?
Yeah, in principle, you're right. You could have something like that, but then this would be something like this case probably, where you have two non-standard interactions, and you would assume that one non-standard interaction and a standard model interaction is dominant over two non-standard interactions. But there might be exceptions. There might exist exceptions where you have some new light particle here and two strong non-standard interactions which only affect this particle and which are not probe otherwise. Okay, so that thing here is point-like at the nuclear Fermi momentum scale. Which is something like 100 MeV. So that means there could well be, if you consider that light particles have already typically been probed in collider physics, well, particles heavier than 100 MeV but lighter than the TeV scale, that there are TeV scale particles. And this means this can be probed at the LHC. So here you get some complementarity between neutrinoless double beta decay. Okay, this is maybe hidden here. Well, it just says neutrinoless double beta decay LHC complementarity. And so let me give an example for that. An R parity violating SUSY. You have a diagram contributing to neutrinos double beta decay of this type, lambda prime 111, giving rise to U quark and a selectron, giving rise to an electron, neutralino, and Selectron. So the same diagram you can realize at the LHC by taking a UDC lambda prime 111. To create a on-shell, a selectron resonance, you get E plus here, you get a neutralino, and then, for example, you can level decay into something like E plus. Until the E plus D.
Question?
Yes?
I had the impression that the existing limits on R parity breaking the most stringent one has come from, in fact, neutrinos and Olivetti kit. And if that's true, then would the LHC be competitive?
I would come to that.
Okay.
And in fact, it will be. And what's the signal of the thing here? We have one positron.
There are three charges.
Okay. So we have two jets here, and we have the same sign dielectron here, which gives a very nice signature. And actually, if the scalar mass here is large, and this immediately answers Borov's question. So if you have large scalar masses, then this prefers the LHC. So for large scalar masses, the LHC is more sensitive on such processes. And actually, since the smaller scalar masses get more and more excluded, we can say in general the LHC is more sensitive on such chains. So we had a PRL in 2009 with Ben Alanak, Steve Combe, and myself. We had a plot like this. Under prime going from 0.002 to 0.005. And this was in an MSUGRA framework where you have these universal scalar masses at the MSUGRA scale. For illustration, we showed the bounds in this plot. So this region here was excluded by neutrinos double beta decay. And so then we showed what future double beta decay experiments will exclude. And then in comparison, the LHC had a sensitivity like this. And this was with 10 inverse femtobarn and center of mass energy of 14 keV. So if we go to more femtobarn, this goes even more into the direction of the LHC.
So the future
Neutron Delta indicates about 500 GeV? I don't know. I can check. Let me see. Now it goes
higher.
So Heinrich, you can show us the plots in color if you want.
yes, I have some plots. I thought this one is not so important. I have other plots I have actually on the slides. Okay. Now, this is not the only example where you can probe short-range neutrinos double beta decay, right? Only neutrinos double beta decay, which is triggered by these heavy particles, can be probed at the LHC, not this mass mechanism stuff. But this one can be probed typically at the LHC, and other examples, very prominent also, is left-right symmetry, where you have TeV scale, right-handed W bosons. So there are papers by Coyne and Semyanovich already from 1983, and a newer one from Tello and Nefsek, Nesty and Semyanovich. In 2011. So of course, now this is all very model dependent, and the question is, can we do something more general, something like such a general approach here, actually? So in my PhD thesis, we talked about this decomposition of this blob here into the various contributions. This was me, Martin Hirsch, Sergei Kovalenko, and Dr. Klein-Grothaus. And we derived limits on these effective interactions in the various structures which are allowed by Lorentz invariants, and published that in 1999 and 2001. And now the question would be, can we get something similar at the NHC, so that we can directly compare in a more model-independent way neutron star beta decay and LHC physics? And indeed, this is possible, but the question is, can we get a general approach also at LHC? And indeed, this is possible, but in this case, it is necessary to go beyond the effective field theory approach we adopted here with these blobs, where we integrated out heavy particles. And these heavy particles we integrated out here are, of course, the ones we want to produce resonantly here. So what we need is a systematic decomposition of the d equal 9 neutrino double beta decay operator so this thing here, or you can just write it like this, 1 over mass to the power of 5, and then you have u bar, dd. And luckily, Walter and collaborators, they did this work, and they actually decomposed these vertices into the possibilities which can arise here without integrating out the heavy particles.
Is Toshi Ota was it most of the way? Toshi Niko Ota.
Yeah, yeah. So I think the paper was on a Hirsch, Ota, Winter in 2013, and they looked what can happen there, and they found out on tree level you can have two topologies which look like this. And so the straight line is a fermion, and the wiggled line is either a scalar or a vector. So so which means here on the internal lines, you can have either vector fermion vector, or scalar fermion scalar, or scalar fermion vector. And here you can have either scalar, 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 vector, 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 scalar, 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 vector. And then you assign your external particles in the neutron star beta decay to the outer legs, and then gauge invariance determines what particles you can have here. And so then you just go through all gauge invariant possibilities. Giving rise to this operator. And now that you actually have the possibilities and what can happen on the internal legs, now you can apply that to the LHC and resonantly produce these particles.
How many possibilities are there?
What
are 40?
Well, no, I don't really know the number. Do you know the number?
I think it's like one page for the left topology and half a page if you miss them for the right topology.
So what
the last number of
what the, in the right topology, where let the number violation happen to?
Yeah, let the number violation happens. I don't think we say where it exactly happens. So you can assign it to different vertices.
Yes.
Well, but in this vertices, if you have, so I'm not sure how you're gonna assign, how you can have let the number violation from this. If you have fermion vector vertex, I'm not sure how there can be lepton number violation there.
Well, I mean, lepton number violation in the standard model is something you get by accident, right? I mean, it's a consequence of your particle content in your theory. As I said in the beginning, if you add a right-handed neutrino, you immediately get lepton number violations,
right,
once you get
so
it by random.
So
here you add some new particles, and automatically, if the quantum numbers work out, you get lepton number violation.
Daniel, I can give an explicit example on the right diagram. You could have a double charge scalar coupling to two electrons,
yeah.
And then it mixes with some normal Higgs doublet. That mixing, trilinear vortex will violate the electron number.
So the second, the right hand diagram can be generated with that two C's.
Double charge scalar here.
So the that two C's can generate the second, the right hand diagram. It's the right hand diagram that can't be generated with that two C's, I believe. So I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm not saying it's impossible. I can think also, but I think that there are some of the combinations there, SSS, BBB, BBS. So I know how to do it with three scalars inside, but I think that there are some combinations where at least I don't see straightforwardly that you can have the number of electrons in that diagram.
The point is you put at the external X, you put your two D quarks, your two U quarks, and your two electrons. That means the internal legs define that there is lepton number violation. And then you put here something into the middle, which is allowed by gauge invariance. And it's as soon as the diagram is allowed by gauge invariance, it has lepton number violation, right? I think it's difficult to say where exactly the lepton number violation is, right?
Well,
if you have a look at the seesaw 2. Where you have something like this, right? You have a triplet here, you have two Higgs doublets here. So where's the lepton number violation in this diagram? Is it here? Is it there?
No, but you cannot put a vector running inside the diagram. Running inside the diagram, you cannot put a vector. That's a perfect example of what I'm saying, which is that I think that maybe not all of these combinations here are possible in this three decomposition. So in that diagram, I know how I can do it with a scalar going inside, but not with a vector.
I think you find examples for all these possibilities.
Sorry.
the question is which quantum numbers they have.
It's entirely trivial. I mean, we also did this in two different configurations, right? It was rechecked by another student of Martin Hirsch as well, and there was some deviations, but at the end there was agreement, like that the possibilities which we finally listed after some erratum that satisfied this criteria. But it's not entirely trivial to work this out. So.
Okay. So, so anyways, as soon as we have that, now we can apply it to the LHC. And so we did that. So in particular, Juan Carlos Hilo did it. And Martin Hirsch, Daniel Kovalenko, and I put our names on the paper. And what we found out is at the LHC, the results for scalars and vectors are very similar. So we concentrated on scalars, and then, so the cases we had were normal scalars with some charge assigned, leptoquark scalars with some charge assigned, meaning that L lepton number is unequal to zero and baryon number is equal to zero, and diquark scalars with some charge assigned, meaning that baryon number was plus minus 2/3. And we concentrated on the first topology here, on this one. But again, the results for the second topology are very similar if you come to conclusions. So you have one scalar here, some fermion here, one scalar here, and you can write down the amplitude for neutrino star the beta decay, which is something like the couplings here, G1, G2, G3, G4. Divided by scalar mass squared, fermion mass, and the other scalar mass squared. And we would define this as G effective to the power of 4 over M effective to the power of 5. And then we could determine bounds in the G effective versus M effective parameter space. And so I show a color plot. So these are here the different possibilities to have. We have something do we have some stick or something to punch at this? Ah, okay. Good. So here you have the diquark, the leptoquark, the normal scalar with different charges. And the one you produce resonantly. And then you show it in this plot, G effective versus M effective. and you have various bounds from neutrinos double beta decay. So this black region here is the present bound, so this is excluded already by neutrinos double beta decay. And so this here is what will be improved if the half-life of neutrinos double beta decay goes up to 10 to 26 years. So this is for xenon 136, but the germanium bounds are similar. Then both these were conservatively taken with the operator, which produces the smallest rate for neutrinos double beta decay. And then for comparison, there are also the largest rate operators for half-life larger than 10 to the 26 and 20 to the 27 years, which produce these bounds here. And now, in comparison to the plot I showed before, this now is with I think 30 inverse femtobarn. Actually 300 inverse femtobarn, 300 inverse femtobarn, and assuming the LHC sees less than three possible events. It doesn't really depend on the number of events, but so these plots are more optimistic than the one I showed before, since this has simply more inverse femtobarn, but it reflects the sensitivity of the LHC.
But the background and everything is not taken into account here, right? So it's in this sense, the LHC sensitivity must be quite aggressive. Neutrinos double beta decay in this plot.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, these three events is a kind of a simple estimate, probably, like a theorist's guess.
Of course, yeah. Of course.
So in a realistic analysis, probably it's going to be much weaker, the LHC unit.
Not much weaker. It might be a little weaker, but not much.
I didn't get that. The three events were three events.
Well, three candidate events would give rise to these bounds. So an upper bound on this signal, two jets plus a like sign dileptron, and you have three candidate events. This would give an upper bound on the. On these,
you're not missing any neutrinos.
Okay, so
this is an involving jets.
So,
that's not so easy.
No, the signal is actually quite clear since this lag sign dileptron is a pretty clear signal.
But the two jets are the opening angle between them.
I don't really remember the details, but
the search is not for a naive question. If three events, how long would you have to run to get three events?
Well, that depends of course on the couplings and the masses and so on and the strengths. But these plots are for 300 inverse femtobarn. This defines, depending on the.
How does that unit transform into running current or something like that?
I don't know. I don't know the exact number of years, but it's a reasonable.
Years we're talking about. Okay. Thank you.
No decades.
Inverse femtobarns can be translated into kind of normal LHCs, 300 crazy LHC upgrades, 1,000 and so on.
Sorry, but so when you do this, you search for just the light sign leptons, and you also require the two jets. If you require the two jets, it has to be systematic.
Yeah. I have to remind myself on the details, but and it is a pretty clear signal.
And the question is, are these standard SUSY model nodes that people are looking for independently or not?
They look for these.
So they've done that.
Yeah. Okay. So what you see here is that with the exception of these leptoquark particles here, typically the LHC searches are better than the neutrino star orbital beta searches.
I'm going to be aggressive or something.
So,
because I mean, the neutrino star orbital decay limits, they must be pretty clean, right? I mean, this is, there's not so much which you can play around with. It's just the nuclear matrix element uncertainty, more, right? Which probably does not enter the limit so much.
And oh, of course.
It's quite straightforward.
I mean, there you also can argue. But, no, I mean, well.
Okay.
I mean, even if you have three times as many signals, this doesn't change the curse a lot. I mean, so that shows you.
No, but what Boris mentioned earlier, that for instance, I mean, if you have particular missing energy cuts or so, you affect this analysis. I mean, probably you want to make a lot of cuts to increase your signal over background ratio, and then the three events may change by a factor of 10 easily. Yeah, I don't know.
No, sure.
Now,
that's what typically happens.
Yeah. That's what happens. As I said, I have to remind myself on the details, but it is not complicated. So in general, what you get is with the exception of lepton quarks, the LHC is more sensitive than neutrino star orbital. On these kinds of processes, of course. So that means if you have a neutrino star beta decay signal, then you also should get an LHC signal, or of course neutrino star beta decay is produced by a long-range operator with light particles. Example giving the mass mechanism. Then you won't see anything on the universe. And on the other hand, if you have no LHC signal, then you also wouldn't get neutrino star beta decay. Or again, neutrino star beta decay is long range.
Or you have leptin quarks.
Yeah, right. So then the nice thing about the LHC, in addition to that, I just want to briefly mention it, is that we also can use the LHC to discriminate between the different scenarios contributing to neutrino star beta decay. So if we on this upper branch, we see neutrino star beta decay, we also get an LHC signal. With neutrino star beta decay, we don't know what mechanism actually produced it, right? Well, we can do a little bit by comparing different nuclei, or we can look at the opening angle and the energy distributions of the electrons, but it's very difficult to actually discriminate the mechanisms. Now, we can use the LHC, and if we produce, for example, a selectron resonantly, we have a peak in our cross-section for our process, and this peak is at the same position where the mass of the selectron is, which we find via some other process. So we know, well, this is probably due to operative violation and resonant selectron production. So we get these invariant mass peaks, and in addition, we can also look at the like sign dileptons and see how many do we get with positive charges, how many do we get with negative charges. This depends, of course, once on the initial particles of the LHC. We have protons, we don't have antiprotons, but it also depends on the diagram, since some diagrams produce a larger charge asymmetry and some produce smaller charge asymmetry. So this is shown here in this plot. Here again, our particles produced resonantly are shown, and here is the number of positive like sign dileptons versus number of negative like sign dileptons. And depending on the particles we produced here, this gives a different charge asymmetry, also depending on the mass of the particle which is produced. Okay, now the third point I wanted to talk about, the baryon asymmetry of the universe. And there was a paper by Frank Deppisch, Julia Hartz, Martin Hirsch this year, PRL 112/2014, 221/61, and the title was Falsifying High-Scale Leptogenesis. At the LHC. And so I don't go through the details here, but the basic argument was once you have lepton number violation at the LHC, then you get a lower bound on the washout factor for lepton asymmetry in the early universe. Well, I mean, you see you have lepton number violation. So if you create a lepton asymmetry, then you have these lepton number violating interactions, and you can show that there will be an equilibrium. So your lepton number asymmetry gets distributed evenly over leptons and anti-leptons in the sky.
But aren't they assuming something that's beyond, for example, plain vanilla type 1 seesaw, which would lead to no signal at the LHC, as far as I know?
What?
If you have a plain vanilla type 1 seesaw, you have very heavy neutrinos that are not made at the LHC, you're not going to see any lepton number violation at the LHC.
So,
yeah, and you're not going to falsify anything.
No,
that's true. It says only if you see lepton number violation at the LHC, then you can falsify leptogenesis. I mean, if you don't see anything at the LHC, you can't falsify anything. I mean,
what's the model? Is it effective field theory based, or how does that
work? Yeah, this is not more. This does not depend on the model at all.
Doesn't depend on the model. And actually, you can even make stronger arguments, and I come to that. So so even more if you consider Svalerons now. So leptogenesis, you remember, works like that. you have a V minus L violating decay of your right-handed neutrino. And you have, in addition, V plus L violation from swallowrons. So this gives you a B minus L asymmetry. And then if you combine it with a B plus L asymmetry, you get a B asymmetry. So that's how leptogenesis works. And the argument in this paper was, well, if you have this B minus L asymmetry, but then you also have B minus L violation, which you see at the LHC, then this year won't be out of equilibrium anymore. So essentially, it swaps back, and the B minus L asymmetry is washed out, and you don't get a B asymmetry. But you also can, by general, turn this argument of leptogenesis around and say, if you have B minus L violation, example given at the LHC, and you add B plus L violation due to swallowrons, and you combine that, then you get B violation, and that means you get B washout. So the point here is, even more than what this paper by Deppisch et al. Says, large lepton number violation at the LHC or elsewhere will not only watch out a pre-existing lepton asymmetry and falsify leptogenesis, but it will wash out any pre-existing baryon asymmetry.
This is very bad.
Irrespective of the baryogenesis mechanism. Yeah, I want to entertain you.
So that means we cannot exist.
No, it just means you cannot see lepton number violation at the LHC.
Well, we also can generate our baryon number at low scales, right?
That's the other option.
So people have worked on low scale baryon number, low scale baryogenesis, right? Plus Yila, I think, this paper is on that, right?
Yes, but I don't understand how they can make this thing. I didn't read the paper, but...
But you also wrote a paper about this stuff, right? I cite you. So the original paper, actually, is quite old.
So,
it's from Gita Yanagida. '90, it's called swallowron-induced baryon number non-conservation. Swallowron-induced. And a constraint on Majorana neutrino masses. So in following up to that, there was Germini Yanagida in 1992, where you explored this constraint a little more in detail, and you found out that the neutrino mass below the electroweak scale would be allowed, right? But above the electroweak scale was excluded. There were lots of papers following this. For example, in the group where I got my PhD, there was a paper constraining light lepton number violating neutrinos. And the baryonic of the universe was by Klaptor, Klein, Rothaus, Stefan Kolb, and Vadim Kuzmin. And, for example, we used this bound in 2011. We wrote a paper, Hollenberg, myself, and Dario Schaller, where we deduced if you have a first generation neutrino, then it has to be heavy. An active neutrino has to be heavy in order not to contribute to the Wiss of the Z boson. But then it can't be a Majorana neutrino, since if it's a Majorana neutrino, it will lead to washout of the Baryonic symmetry. So this has to be a pseudo-Dirac neutrino or a Dirac neutrino with a mass splitting smaller than keV.
Heinrich, this statement at the top of the board that there would be a washout irrespective of the baryogenesis mechanism. You need the Swaylorin process to act as part of that. Is that not the case?
That's true, yeah.
But the Swaylorin process, as I understand it, understanding nothing about the Swaylorin process, is that it ceases to be effective when you get down to somewhere around the electroweak phase transition, 100, 200 GeV, something like this. Suppose you see electron number violation, but you see it at a scale somewhat below that.
Then
you don't wash everything out.
That's true. Yeah, yeah. But I'm talking here about lepton number violation at the LFC, which would be at the TV scale, right?
I
agree.
If you have lepton numbers, so in the basic argument, if you start with lepton number violation at the LFC, this does not require not even Rayleigh neutrinos.
No.
So then in the argument left again is what is the Rayleigh neutrino decay? So why is Rayleigh neutrino part of the argument that follows?
It isn't. I'm talking now at this argument here. B minus L violation at the LHC without anything. You combine this B minus L violation with the B plus violation, so you get B washout. Whatever produced your Baryonic symmetry only in the universe.
So that's spectacular. If you observed lepton number violation at the LHC, it will mean that you have basically proven baryogenesis, right? Because you cannot have a pre-existing Baryonic symmetry. It cannot be leptogenesis either, but there has to be a baryogenesis mechanism.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, there might be loopholes. You might introduce some additional symmetries. For example, you confine your Baryon asymmetry to one flavor sector, which is hidden from the lepton number violation you see at the LFG. Okay. So there might be loopholes, but the punchline in general is this.
There is such a class of models which goes by the name post Swaylorin baryogenesis.
Okay.
So we are all ready for.
So
I think they are referring all that always when you do generate an asymmetry for the same process, erases what happened before. You erase some mechanics and then when it goes out of equilibrium or something, you generate it again. So every mechanism that produces electron number asymmetry erases at least part of what was produced before.
Yes.
I think that this is, and they must have. So this is true, and it's of course true. But the issue is, what is that they consider? How is that they prove that anything that will be seen at the LHC will do this before this kind of transition? Because of course, an energy scale is not the same as the normal energy scale.
And you probably need to write down some kind of mechanism what you test, or I don't know. but when yeah, you have to make
problem. Some connection, yeah. Because an energy scale is an energy scale, you produce and whatever. And then how do you connect this energy scale with the history of the universe, something that actually happened, is always a next step to assume. So in principle, the universe never have passed through a phase in which there was a radiation dominating the universe with 200 GeV energy. And we, as I always say, the only the lower bound, so the let's say.
Yeah, but I'm talking about pre-existing baryon asymmetry. Pre-existing, I mean in the sense that it was produced at higher energy scales. Of course, you can always produce it at lower energy scales.
Yeah, but then you have also to what I mean is that an energy scale doesn't guarantee a moment in the history of the universe in which that will happen.
I agree. I agree. Okay, so conclusion. Is if you have neutrino stopper beta decay, so then either you have a long range mechanism, for example, like my runner mass, or you have a short range mechanism. So if you have a short range mechanism, then you have lepton number violation at the LHC.
I have a stupid question. What other long range mechanisms could we know except from my runner mass? What else could I have? The other light particles? I mean, what other light particles could be there which are neutral?
Well, this was Daniela's question. I don't know. You probably could make up a model like that, but also, I mean, there's a long-range mechanism which involves neutrinos, but which involves this non-standard vertex here, right?
Yeah, but it also involves neutrinos.
Yes. But this is not proportional necessarily to the neutrino mass, so you wouldn't call that a mass mechanism, since you can have a right-handed projector here projecting out the neutrino momentum. So for this, I think you can't make a really clear statement. Since in this blood there might be particles which could be produced at the LHC and could give rise to lepton number violation, but also not. So I think for this guy you can make
it really. If you have that one, you must have the other one leading, right? This is a higher dimensional operator, and you have to have the lower vertex. I mean, you can also have the lower vertex twice.
What is the lower vertex twice?
I mean, isn't it a necessary consequence that you have the long range diagram?
Yeah. But lepton number violation. No, but let the number violate, but this does not happen in the lower vertex. This was the worst.
This is not suppressed, since this can be PR, and it's not proportional to the neutrino mass.
I understand, okay, so you want to have it.
Okay, so
it's still proportional to the neutrino mass.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, the
unless you violate lepton number in your blob, you are forced to have the proportionality to the neutrino mass.
You have a neutrino mass, I agree with that. You have a Majorana neutrino mass. But the amplitude of this process is not proportional to the Majorana neutrino mass. Since the Majorana neutrino mass will be produced at four loop level.
No, but what Bode is saying is that lepton number violation must happen in the blob. Mm-hmm. And the blob is where it must be proportional to the neutrino mass. So in the you must have some lepton number violation happening inside that blob there.
Yeah.
Right-handedness is not sufficient. If you want to avoid some dependence on the neutrino mass, you have to violate lepton number in your blob, whatever it is. If you don't do that,
not only are you proportional
to neutrino mass, you're proportional actually to neutrino mass squared.
I'm talking about the amplitude, right? And not
the amplitude is proportional to neutrino mass squared. Unless you violate lepton number in that blob.
Well, maybe we discuss that later. Let me just put my conclusions in there, then we can go on. So if you have a short-range mechanism for neutrino stopper beta decay, you will have lepton number violation at the LHC, and that means that you will erase your pre-existing baryon asymmetry. That means you get low-scale baryogenesis. And that probably you can also test at the LHC.
So you get something like 2-for-1. I put a question here. In order not to be too bold. And so the other thing is, if you have high-scale baryogenesis, then you have no lepton number violation at LHC.
You said leptogenesis earlier, not baryogenesis.
No, it doesn't depend. Right? I mean, I said you can be more bold and irrespective of any mechanism, any pre-existing baryogenesis will be washed out. So you can be more bold than the Depesch-Hirsch paper. So high-scale baryogenesis means you have no lepton number violation at the LHC. That means if neutrinos have a beta decay, then it's probably due to a long-range mechanism. And this is not a very clear arrow, but in this case, I probably would bet that there's a high-scale origin of the neutrino mass, right? So you know you have baryogenesis from a high scale. You know you don't see any lepton number violation at the LHC. You still see neutrinos double beta decay. You know it's from a long range mechanism, for example, the neutrino mass. Then this might hint towards something like your vanilla seesaw. Okay, yeah, so that's it, yeah.
I have a very simple question. What do you mean by LHC, actually? Do you mean what we have already, the lower energies, and why is the energy of the LHC?
No, I'm talking for about 14 TeV, center of mass energy, and I'm talking about these.
Why is the 14 essential? Why is?
Well, since the energy, of course, depends, the rates for this process depend on the energy, and you will get more signals when you have a higher energy, okay. And we compared the sensitivity of the LHC to neutrinos double beta decay, and so. Here we use these comparisons to make these.
So that means at the present energies that we have already at LHC, none of this would be observable, or the effects would be there, but they were just too rare to.
Well, this is model dependent. I mean, of course, where exactly it would set in is model dependent, but you can say if at 300 inverse femtobarn at 14 TeV center of mass energy, you didn't see any lepton number violation, then this would mean neutrinos double beta decay, if you see it, would be due to a long-range mechanism. On the other hand, if you see neutrinos double beta decay, then you also, and it is due to a short-range mechanism, then you also should see lepton number violation at the LHC, but then you would wash out a pre-existing high-scale variance.
That means from the existing data from the LHC, we wouldn't get any insight on any of these things.
Well, you would get some insights, but not these strong states.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it would be a good project to take a picture of this of the diagram and try to find where one can escape each one of the implications? Is it possible?
If you wish.
Yeah, why not?
It's for sure possible, but still an interesting argument, Jane, I think, because we are always looking for justifications, how we can justify, like, the genesis, for instance, or how we can disprove it. And from that point of view, I mean, we need this kind of, like, semi-quantitative arguments. I mean, it has been studied in modern context, right? So you can say something about specific models as well. So I think it's beautiful.
No, I think this is very nice. So if it works as a, and I have no real reason to doubt, but it seems very strong.
It's not without loopholes. I mean, these are beautiful. For sure, there are plenty of loopholes.
Yeah. Well, I also said, for example, the barrier symmetry argument. You can go around if you confine your lepton or baryon asymmetry into some certain flavor sector, which is decoupled from the lepton number violation you see here. So there are loopholes, and it's definitely it's worth to discuss.
Or you could like generate the material discoverability operator at one loop or whatever. So
that's true, yeah.
So if you're like me, your head's full, why don't we go to cookies and coffee? Thank Heinrich again.
So another way to phrase your conclusion is that since we're not always left to Genesis, and since we're not strong statements